UK Wine Show, show number 112. Palace Juice from Amarim on Cork. On this week's show, we cast the spotlight into wine and health, and we find out about how many units in a 250ml glass of wine. Carlos de Jus from Amarim Cork gives us the lowdown on why he thinks Cork is still the future of wines.
And in the news, New Zealand vintage a bumper crop, new tool to track carbon footprint, and English wine is presidential.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 112 for the 14th of July. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with Carlos Juice. Carlos is a smooth-talking PR man from Amarim, one of the largest cork producers in Portugal. We discuss cork's past, present, and future. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. New Zealand's grape harvest is nearly 40% bigger than 2007 due to very favourable growing conditions in most regions over the summer months and the extra 2,500 hectares of vines that were available for production. 285,000 tonnes of grapes were gathered from a total of 27,000 hectares, with Sauvignon Blanc accounting for 60% of the harvest. Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris also increased significantly, but there was less Chardonnay than in 2007. Marlborough was the biggest region, bringing in 70% of the harvest, but smaller regions such as Central Otago, Wairarapa, Waipara and Canterbury saw massive growth, albeit off a small base. And it doesn't seem like they'll have trouble shifting the extra volume. While the UK is New Zealand's main export market with around 35% of exports, there have been huge increases in sales in the USA, Australia, Canada, Asia and Europe. What do you reckon, Chris?
Well, we talked about a avalanche coming from the New Zealand 2008 crop a wee while ago, but it does look like the whole crop across the board has increased, not just Sauvignon Blanc. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the wines. While the pound has devalued significantly against the euro, it's lost less ground against the New Zealand dollar in the last 6 months or so, making New Zealand wines relatively cheaper than the European wines. So we'll see what happens. What's next, Jane?
Well, next up, a carbon calculator has been developed for the wine industry to help producers assess the environmental impact of their activities. The project was developed and jointly funded by the Wine Institute of California, New Zealand Wine Growers, the Winemakers Federation of Australia, and from South Africa, the Integrated Production of Wine South Africa. It came about as a result of impending regulations in some wine-producing countries and pressure from retailers who are asking producers to quantify their carbon footprint so that they can introduce carbon labels. The calculator is an online tool which comes with its very own protocol designed to establish consistency for making carbon footprint assessments. This protocol covers the whole life cycle of the wine, from growing the grapes up to delivery of the wine to the export market. The current protocol and calculator is not the finished product, though. It's expected there'll be future iterations which will progressively become more accurate as international standards for carbon accounting emerge.
Cheers, Jane. At last, the world's starting to get counting of carbon and wine under control. Amy Russell, who was quoted in the full news clip, says that there's an awful lot to be done, but this is an iterative process and it'd be interesting to see how different countries stack up when all parts of the carbon cycle included, not just those silly headline carbon miles. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, on a lighter note, we're wondering what George Bush makes of our English wine after Denbigh's Bacchus 2004 was served at a dinner that was held for the President by the Prime Minister at 10 Downing Street. The English white wine from the UK's largest producer was among good company with the two fine Bordeaux that followed it. The Bacchus accompanied the starter course at the dinner, which was a trio of Scottish salmon and cherry tomato salad. It's unlikely, though, that George Bush actually got to taste the fruits of our labour. It's reported that he doesn't actually drink alcohol anymore. Well, that's it for our news stories this week, but don't forget you can get more detail on these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Something came up in the news this week that was extraordinarily bad bit of press for Prince Charles. Old Prince Charles, or PC, has been driving around in his Aston Martin running on ethanol. Not a bad story, you say? It's supposed to be a good news PR spin story for him. Environmentally and friendly and all that sort of stuff. But the press guy made an absolute mistake by embellishing a wee bit of the facts. Different news articles were quoting him saying that the ethanol was produced from English wine that no one wanted. In one story, they even said it came from Wiltshire. Now, there is a wine glut in Europe still, but it's certainly not coming from England. After the UK Vintners Association got all uppity about it, they weren't going to tell us where the wine came from. But it's likely to come from France, who gobbles up most of the European subsidies for emergency distillation for vast quantities of wine that nobody wants. To be honest, I feel a bit sorry for old Prince Charles. It must be a curse being in the public eye. It's so easy to be misquoted, or worse still, make a genuine mistake. Making mistakes with wine is easy, whether it's getting the grape variety wrong or the regions. But something that surprised me was how few people made a mistake in this week's spotlight, which is on this month's poll, the number of units in a glass of wine. After a big advertising campaign by the UK government to raise awareness of the different alcohol units, we decided to ask people how many units in a 250ml glass of wine. Was it 1, 2, 3, or 4? The correct answer depends on the alcohol level of the wine. And if the wine ranges between 8 and 16%, the number of units ranges between 2 and 4. However, the most common measure and the amount that the government uses and is promoting is 3 units for a 250ml glass of wine. That's based on 12% alcohol level. With 61% of the people we asked getting it right with 3 units, well, I thought that was an excellent result and indicates that perhaps the campaign is working and the message is getting through. But if 61% got it right, 39% got it wrong. 9% thought it was 4 units, and 29% of people thought it was 2 units. Only 1% of people thought a 250ml glass of wine had only 1 unit in it. That ends this week's spotlight. Next week, we're going to continue our look at wine and health by looking at the limits and what they mean. We also start our new poll, and we're going to be asking people about weekly wine limits for wine. But next up, we talk with Carlos De Jus on cork. As many of you guys know, I'm not necessarily the biggest cork fan in the world. I think it has its place, but with a market share of over 90%, it is way too high. So it was with some interest I interviewed Carlos, and while I certainly feel he didn't answer all my questions, he did answer some, and he got his point of view across very well. Let's have a listen to what Carlos has to say. Hi, I'm here with Carlos De Jus from Amarim. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And you?
Excellent. I'm very, very good. We're going to be talking about corks, closures, all that sort of stuff. Amarim's a pretty big producer of cork closures, and you're based in Portugal.
Indeed, yes. We are based in Portugal, although we export to over 100 countries, 103 countries to be precise, with a market share of roughly 25% of the closure market. Mm-hmm. And it's a company that has been in operation since the 19th century.
Excellent. You've just done a presentation on some of the positive aspects of cork, and I think you had triple bottom line. Do you want to explain what triple bottom line is?
I think it's a concept that fortunately you'll be hearing more and more. It's a concept that really has an importance that transcends the wine industry. It's a concept that I think should format the way that we approach business and life in general. What the concept basically details is, in addition to the traditional financial bottom line, that as long as it goes well, nobody really complains about it, nobody says anything. This is the traditional approach. What the concept adds to that traditional financial bottom line, it's two additional bottom lines, the social bottom line and the environmental bottom line. And what the case I was trying to make during the presentation is that either you have those three bottom lines moving in sync in the same direction, obviously, and then you can consider to have true progress, or having just one out of three or two out of three is really not going to cut it anymore. The reason for that is because you cannot have true progress if you're only racking up a lot of money for our corporations, while at the same time sacrificing the environmental and the social bottom lines.
Not sustainable.
At the end of the day, we're talking about this true sustainability concept that goes way beyond the simple retention of CO2. It's much more than that.
So a lot of people have come out and
favor of cork. The World Wildlife Foundation sort of encouraged people to use cork. What's the local issues in terms of Portugal for using cork?
The social issues, social and the environmental issues, and the financial issues. You have all three there. Indeed, NGOs, large and small NGOs around the world, have supported the utilization of cork, obviously for environmental and social reasons. But I think it's also important to point out that the winemakers, the wine consumers, and the wine distributors are the ultimate responsible for the overwhelming market share of 81% that cork has today. Not the 95 or the 96% that we had maybe 20 years ago, but guess what? That is not bad news for the cork industry necessarily, because you're also bottling much more today. But in terms of the impact that it has, we're talking about an impact that is especially very, very clear. Once you go to these cork forests, when you look at the people that depend on the harvesting of cork, depend on the cork income that is sustained by the utilization of cork stoppers. Mm-hmm. You look at these people, you see the way of life, you see that it has been done the same way for 2,000 years, and that they are able to live in areas that without cork will be straightforward deserts. Social and environmental deserts.
Hypothetically, if the cork business went out of business, what would happen to the forests in the long run?
In the long run, the forest will simply be replaced by other crops. You have to realize that the interest on any crop is to a great extent, the amount of income that that crop can give to a local community. Mm-hmm. If you remove the financial incentives, rural communities and forest owners, because we're talking about people, normal people, we're not talking about big corporations owning big tracts of land like in the case of eucalyptus. Cork manufacturing companies do not own cork forests. So the value added trickles back to the rural communities. Without that, these rural communities would not have the source of income that you have now. I give you one concrete example. The best paid agricultural job in the world is harvesting cork.
Is it?
90 euros a day. Okay, they don't make 90 euros a day, 12 months a year, because probably we'll be there ourselves. But the point I'm trying to make is that during the three and a half months that harvest lasts, they make enough money to fix them to the land. So they will be finding other crops. And guess what? In terms of CO2 retention, you probably could replace that CO2 retention capability that cork oaks have with an eucalyptus. But remember, sustainability is not just about CO2 retention. Sustainability, it's about biodiversity. There's not much biodiversity in a trackland full of eucalyptus, believe me. There's not a lot of rural community fixing, because a trackland full of eucalyptus can be handled by a couple of people and heavy machinery. So the whole ecosystem will be changed and will not be a better ecosystem, will be a much, much more poor ecosystem.
I haven't been up and looked at any cork forest. What sort of biodiversity have you got there?
Quite diverse, if you allow me the pun. Both in quantity and quality. We're talking about one of the 25 hotspot areas in the region, as considered by several NGOs. What this means is that some of the world's most endangered species, the Iberian lynx, the imperial eagle, the black stork, actually have their natural habitat in these cork forests, which, by the way, are the last natural forests in Western Europe, it must be noted. So we're talking about genuine, true, original, quote-unquote, original ecosystem that support an incredible array of life. And those are probably the headline grabbers. You know, we've been talking about the Iberian lynx for ages. The Iberian lynx, by the way, or any endangered species, should not be an excuse for the lack of quality that cork cannot afford not to have. Yeah. All this makes a lot more sense, and it's certainly a good opportunity if the cork industry continues to deliver the quality that the market demand. Otherwise, the Iberian lynx will have a rough period, of course. Yeah. But again, the point I'm trying to make is that in addition to those big headline grabbers, we're talking about an infinity of small bees, of small lizards, of small ants, and flora, not just fauna, but also flora, that create, again, an ecosystem that it's the ultimate example of the ability to create wealth while at the same time protecting the environment. And I think cork and the manufactured cork products embody that balance that today we look for more than ever. And fortunately, we are looking for that balance.
One of the key problems with cork, particularly in the past and still a effect today, is cork taint or TCA. Now, I'll tell you the advice I give people and you can comment on why you think I'm wrong or right.
On the record?
On the record. All right. So the advice I tell people is, if you want to use plastic corks, that's fine. Buy them from a fast-moving wine that you know is going to be on the shelf because they've got a short lifespan. And, you know, if you're buying it from the supermarket for something like Jacob's Creek or something like that, fine, go for it. You know, it's moving fast, so that's fine. Don't buy it from your corner dairy because you just don't know how long it's been there for. And so it's got a short shelf life because of the oxidation going through. Screw caps, brilliant for all short-term wines, you know, a year, 2 years, no oxygen. Some issues with reductive effects in wine, but that's more of a winemaker's problem, I think. And cork, if you want to use cork, that's fine, particularly for older wines, but don't ever buy one bottle of an old wine and keep it for years under cork, because if you open it up and it's TCA or got cork taint, you're going to be really disappointed.
So you're going to give me all those Chateau Petrus you have at home? I'll take them. Tell your, tell your listeners that all the great wines of this world that, by the way, all have cork in, if they don't want them, I'll be glad to receive
them. No, I've rebottled them under screw cap. No.
But you may not want to keep a screw cap for 30 years in your cellar, but in your humid cellar, but that's a different issue. But seriously, I think, first of all, what needs to be clearly articulated is that monopolies are not good for anybody. And I think when we go back to a few years ago and some people were predicting this parade down Victory Lane for the screw caps that were going to literally and figuratively take over the world, I think that's the kind of thought that I'm not very comfortable with. Just like I would not be very comfortable with the thought of cork getting such a predominant position again, that the drive for quality, the incentive to invest in money will be lost. Mm-hmm. Balance, I think, is the key on anything in life, and in this particular case, it's more than ever. Assessing your advice, if you allow me so.
Yeah, sure.
I think there are some issues that need to be highlighted. One of them is, and if you allow me, is how come cork is good enough for the best wines in the world, but not good enough for everyday wines? I think it's a proposition that some consumers might have a problem dealing with. But your assessment hinges on three types of stoppers. And to be honest with you today, I don't see anyone defending plastic stoppers. I don't see anyone suggesting that they are the way forward. I think what we're increasingly looking at, it's a binary almost situation between cork and screw caps. So
I've had winemakers who use it say, time and place for it, and as long as it's moving through and fast, it's like Tetra Pak or any other thing. As long as it's got fast throughput, it's not a problem. It's only when it sits on the shelves for any period of time.
The question then would be, how fast is fast? And let me point out one thing. The first peer review study on oxygen ingress was published in September 2005 by the University of Bordeaux. Okay, very interesting. It measures, of course, the ingress of oxygen throughout different types of closures. And what you're going to see is that in the case of the plastic stoppers used in that study, in one case, after, I believe, 135 days, the oxygen ingress measuring device jammed because there was so much of it. In the second case, after a little bit under 300 days, so roughly, let's consider it even a year, that oxygen ingress was also so high that the mechanism stopped measuring it. The point I'm trying to make is, if you're considering that it takes a month for a wine to be shipped, say, from Chile to, could be a UK harbor or any other harbor in the Northern Hemisphere, it's going to take months. Mm-hmm. For that to achieve. And by the way, you might as well just have to spend maybe a month or two sitting before it's being shipped. So right there you have what, 5 months?
Sure.
5.5 months?
Yeah.
Plus, how long does it take for that wine to actually reach the shelf? A few weeks, perhaps. And right there, you probably already have some kind of problem. And I think that's the reason why so many people complain about the excessive oxidation with plastic stoppers. Probably has something to do with that. But in addition to that, do you control the moment of drinking? You control the moment of purchasing, but you cannot control the moment of drinking. And let's assume for a second that only 5% of people make the decision of keeping that wine for a few more months. that, in theory, a 5% failure rate. And if 5% is not acceptable for cork, of course it isn't, should not be accepted for any other kind of closure.
Yeah, that is it, but most wine bought in supermarket, which is where I'd recommend people buy it, it's consumed within the day or two. So,
absolutely. I would assume that 95%, 96%, 97%. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's probably not the safest option. I think nowadays, if someone, for whatever reason, chooses not to use natural cork, I think there are other options, and that's the point I was trying to make. Yep. There are better more options. Effective
what would,
so rather than a plastic stopper, which has absolutely, in my opinion, and in a lot of people's opinion, including some leading wine critics around the world, by the way, don't see a single one of them defending plastic stoppers today. I think there's really no reason to use one of those today.
All right, let's move on to screw caps then.
Okay.
Because obviously there's been a lot said about reductive issues or, you know, that sort of sulfury character you get in screw caps. Most winemakers I talk to say, well, as long as you put a wee bit less sulfur in there and you look after what you're doing, you shouldn't really have a problem. It's more of a problem with winemakers who aren't experienced with the product. What's your take on that?
I don't think we should have a take on that. The cork professional, should have any take on that whatsoever. I think those decisions should be left to the professional, should be left to the people with a PhD in chemistry. And I think we should hear what those people have to say. And I can give you one example. There's one gentleman, and I'm totally at liberty to mention his name because he's not a client of us, of ours. It's Dr. Alan Limmer in New Zealand.
Yep. Now,
he's the only person that has a combination of these following characteristics. PhD in chemistry. He's a fellow of the New Zealand Academy. A winemaker with some success. And he's also, by the way, New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah.
I think when someone with all these credentials says that be careful about the utilization of screw caps and the preponderance and the propensity for reduction post-bottling reduction,
yep,
and has nothing to do with pre-bottling possible reduction, I think we should listen to what these people say, what this person has to say, because of these credentials. When this person says, and many other, Dr. Pascal Stratonet is someone else that tells you exactly the same thing. AWRI, I believe, has raised the issue also, and so the ETS and Camden and the countless scientific institutions in the world of wine, when they point out that the utilization of copper, it's a bit like the atomic bomb. It's good to have it, but you don't really want to use it.
Yep.
Because it really wipes out the good and the bad mercaptans, I'm sorry. Because in the case of Sauvignon Blanc, for example, guess what? That mercaptan, it's an intrinsic part of the characteristic of the varietal. By using copper, it's not a smart bomb. Copper is not a smart bomb. You cannot direct it to that specific type of mercaptan or to that.
Yeah, what you're saying, a lot of people, you can clean up the sulfur, the reductive notes with using copper. But it's not, most winemakers who use screw cap don't necessarily copper their wines. They just make sure that they minimize the sulfur use before bottling.
Well, then it will be difficult to justify the incredible increase of the sales of copper in certain countries of the Southern Hemisphere, wouldn't it? I think, if you allow me, the question is a bit even more difficult and complicated for that. One of the toughest questions that I think anyone could have asked anyone in the cork industry a few years ago, and they still ask, and this is still a valid question, because let's not forget that there are 600 cork companies in existence. It's not realistic to think that all of them are going to move in the right direction with the same speed and the same conviction. So a few years ago, people would ask, and again, they still do, that, well, I don't have a problem with TCA, that it's obviously there. I don't have a problem with the 10, the 12, the 15 nanograms of TCA that clearly make that wine undrinkable. My problem is with the levels of TCA that around 2, 3, 4 nanograms, depending on the wine, that really take away the vibrancy of the wine, the fruit strips the fruit. That's the problem that I have.
Because you drink the wine, you don't...
Get excited about it.
It's like, it's not that good a wine.
You don't go back and buy a second one.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't know why.
Does more damage than a faulty wine.
Absolutely, because it's more insidious. Yeah. But guess what? What they're discussing is what it's called sub-perception threshold contamination. Meaning, it's not really... sensory-wise, it's not there. It is, but it isn't. So you don't really know what it is. You just don't get excited. Don't buy a second bottle. Guess what? Subperception threshold reduction has very much the same kind of sensory impact. So I think when we discuss reduction, we need to discuss reduction that it's blatant and obvious. Yes. But what about that reduction that it's not blatant and obvious? What is being done about that? Millions and millions of bottles have been bottled and stopped with a screw cap under certain premises. And I think those premises today increasingly are being recognized as not being completely valid. So what are we going to do about it? Anything? Well, apparently the screw cap manufacturers are coming up with different liners that allow for some oxygen ingression.
Yeah, yeah.
But wasn't the whole point of using screw caps to create an anaerobic environment?
No, the object was to remove TCA.
That was one of the objects. Yeah, yeah. The other object was also to deal with certain issues. But let me point out one thing.
Or at least get more controllable oxygen ingression.
But no, there's no controllable when there's nothing getting in. There's no controllable.
And
let me point out
The new screw caps at least you can dial up the amount of oxygen ingression, whereas it's only in the
not
really
that
good
easy.
Quality
it's not cores. That easy. Those liners are in some cases still being researched, which means that they're still many years away from being valid. But the point I was trying to make is what about those millions of bottles filled, yep, purchased under a certain assumption that today we know is not correct. I just want to point out one thing.
Yep.
About why people move to one different type of packaging versus another. Can you come up with one example in the history of mankind of an industry that moved from a more expensive product to a least expensive product for the sake of the consumer? Because I don't. And I don't think no one can, because that probably never happened. The point I'm trying to make is, let's not discount the fact that cost also has, obviously, to play a role in the decisions that large and small companies need to make. And I think today, even if you accept for a second, let me concede that to you for a second, that all the marketing issues are the same. All things are equal between cork and screw caps.
Mm-hmm.
The marketing issues, the reduction issues are not there. The consumer preference is not there. The premiumization that certain types of package can give to some wines,
yep,
it's not there. All things are equal. If all things are equal, and we are at the conference that is discussing global change, then what about the sustainability issues? Wouldn't that still tip the scales back to cork? This is something that we need to analyze going forward.
Yeah. I one of the problems with cork is it's a closure for glass, and a lot of people are saying glass is not an environmentally friendly product for wine. So if the trouble with using cork as an environmental argument is it's a closure for an unenvironmentally friendly product, and maybe the solution is to move completely away from that.
I think we have another chance in the wine industry to wait for all the data to come in before we make blanket statements and sweeping decisions about... Remember, and again, back to the plastic stoppers, 10 years ago, 6 years ago, go back and check what people were saying and writing about plastic stoppers and how that was the way forward, and everybody rushed in that direction and, oh, sorry, it didn't work, let's try something else. I think regarding new forms of packaging to deal with CO2 emissions, I think, again, we have the chance now to wait, reflect on issues, and make sure that we make the right decisions. And if the right decisions is to go the way of a carton, great, we'll deal with that somehow. But I think we need to assess a few issues here. First of all, as you just heard inside the conference, the president of one of the largest wineries in the world pointing out some problems about using
bag and box
yeah, and wine.
And Miguel Torres, he wasn't happy about bag and box, was he?
He wasn't. And you know what kind of worrisome points he made about that utilization. But I think we don't even need to get that far. I think we need to realize two things. First of all, is that the best solution to deliver the wine the way the winemaker wants it? Question number one. Is the consumer ready to use that kind of packaging? That's a binary question, obviously. But I think we also have to ask the question, does it work? And if it does, for what kind of wines? Because let the consumer and the wineries make that decision based on what is the real footprint of digging bauxite, open sky bauxite mines, by the way, to extract the aluminium that does not go to a screw cap, but goes to the liner inside the bag in the box. Let's not forget about that. Let's consider also, if the wineries want to erase the premiumization that goes with the bottle and the cork, do they want to do that? Can they afford to do that? Because let me ask you something. What about if we can come up with a solution that involves thinner glass, much lighter glass, with a natural cork on top of it that has that tremendous CO2 retention? What about if that proposition was carbon neutral or close to carbon neutral? Wouldn't that be a wonderful solution?
And the glass was square, so you got higher volume density in your packaging.
We can make square corks.
This cork can be round. We just need a square bottle.
You know, you can shape cork into almost anything. We use cork for, obviously, for wine. That's still 70% of the value added comes from that application. That's why it's so important that the wine industry continues to support cork the way it has been for so many years. But it also used in the aerospace industry, auto industry, shoes. Some of the most well-known names in the world of fashion last year were all seem to be doing platform shoes made of cork. So you really can shape it into anything you want.
Okay. I want to talk a wee bit about TCA and what you guys are doing. I'm of all the cork closures, you know, we have some wines that we run in our tastings and they are habitually quite often corked. You go, I'm going to open this bottle of wine. I've got maybe a 1 in 10 chance it's going to be corked, maybe even worse than that. The really bad ones we just drop and we use another wine. But the cork industry took a long time to get their house in order, at least try to get the house in order. I've used Diam now and I really like Diam closures. They're a bit energy intensive making them, but compared to a screw cap, they're not that bad. So can you talk a wee bit about what the cork industry is doing to improve the quality of cork?
I think the cork industry took the proverbial kick in the pants that it needed. Because we enjoy the...
I'm pleased you said that, because I've always... I think it needed a dirty great kick.
Oh, we did. Yeah. You know, I always think of a very well-known car manufacturer that as late as the late 70s, we're still saying that we don't need seatbelts in our cars. Meanwhile, the Swedes were doing what we know about. And you look today and God knows how many airbags most of the cars have today. Industries in general do not move into a certain direction unless they are forced to do that, pushed to do that. And I think in the case of the cork industry, I think we have a combination of that monopolistic approach that was already sinking in. And at the same time, genuine puzzling at how come people don't understand what it is that we're trying to do. I joined this industry only 5 years ago. I had nothing to do with wine. I had nothing to do with cork. I was quietly on the other side of the pond, you know, doing my thing. And by the time I joined the company, people were working very, very hard to defeat the problem that, let me point out, is a naturally occurring, omnipresent problem. Trichloroanisole, TCA contamination is not exclusive of the cork industry. It's a problem of the coffee industry. They have a fancy name for it, by the way. They call it the Rio taint. It's a problem of beer. One of the biggest brewers in Canada recently had a big TCA problem. But I saw these people working really, really hard. And I saw some plants that were being inaugurated in 2000 or had been inaugurated in 2000, 2001. Plants that are the size of 7 or 8 football fields. To inaugurate a plant in 2000 that has that dimension, I can assure you, it took years to plan, design, to fund, to make sure that it was the right approach. So the really hard work did not start with the new plants in 2000. It started with the planning of those new plants as far back as the mid-90s. And it hurt, genuinely, to hear some people saying that the cork industry was not doing anything except talking about Iberian Lynx. And by the way, being right ahead of time sometimes is as bad as being wrong altogether. And now we're back again with the biodiversity. But it was genuinely hurtful to see these colleagues of mine working so hard and hearing people saying they're not doing anything. A lot was done. And especially what was done was the design of a strategy that had necessarily to combine two things: preventative measures and curative measures. Some closures, and I'm talking about cork closure, we just mentioned one of them not long ago, rely solely on curative measures. Those are great. They grab the headlines.
Yep, that's your Diam.
They make people really happy. It's a bit like public health. We all love magic pills We all love, you know, solutions in a little pill that we can take. Unfortunately, something that is measured in nanograms, parts per trillion, it's not likely to go away just with a magic bullet. You need to have solid preventative measures.
Yep.
And it's a combination of both, plus gas chromatography analysis, plus really high standards such as HACCP, such as ISO 9000, all this certification, all this alphabet soup, as I call it, that we have. HACCP, BRC, FSC, you name it, all these acronyms that stand for something, of course, that together create a risk management policy that it's strong enough to make sure that the problems do not occur or occur as little as possible. Let me point out one thing. To put 250 people inside a tin can of aluminium, ship it up in the air 34,000 feet, it's not a good idea. Yet, millions of us do it every year. Some of us more reluctantly, but we all ended up getting inside an airplane.
Yep.
Airplanes, unfortunately, sometimes fall. It's not because they are perfect that we board them. It's because we believe in the risk management policies of the company building the airplane and the company operating the airplane. The same airplane operated by company A can give you a lot of peace of mind, but that very same airplane operated by company B may not give you the same peace of mind. It is, at the end of the day, because you believe in the risk management policies. And I think if we can persuade people that that is a good idea, that tin can of aluminium is a good idea, I think if you deliver the right risk management policy, as we have been doing, then you do have a future as bright as our past. And let me point out just one more thing. 7.7% net increase in the number of corks sold in the third quarter of 2007. Those are our last public releasable figures.
Yep.
Being a public company, I cannot tell you what the fourth quarter is going to be. But I can tell you that 2006 was the best year ever since the company was founded, as I said earlier, on the 19th century. We are clearly doing something right.
Yep.
What is not going to happen is that a cork industry is going to get out on the other end of this tunnel with the same number of companies that it got in. How many brands of cars did you have 30 years ago, and how many do you have today? We need perhaps less cork companies, but we certainly need better cork companies. And that's what, in a nutshell, I think we have been aiming to through myriads of different tactics and strategies that we have developed to defeat something that even in Australia today, people recognize that it's much better than it was. I'm not promising you perfection, but I'm promising you what the most successful industries in the history of the world have had, solid risk management policies.
I quoted a figure at you earlier in the conference of 5% cork taint. You said you don't think it was anywhere near that high. Not necessarily for your company's products, but for the industry as a whole. Given that things like wine, the International Wine Spirit Competition, when they do it, they publish their results.
Which was?
I think it was around 7%.
Not the latest one, not the penultimate one, which is substantially lower than that.
What was it? What was the last one?
3.1 or something like that.
Okay.
And, last year was 2.something, and actually, I want to commend the IWC for doing something that has never been done before, albeit in a methodologically flawed way, but they try to address head on an issue which was not just about the cork taint, it was about the whole
fault levels
range of problems that we had, be it with reduction of the screw caps or TCO with cork, didn't matter. And I think they did a good attempt at doing that rather than the blanket statements and the alarmistic statements of the past as if there was nothing else failing except cork. I think the 5% failure rate as a whole, I don't think it's accurate, and I don't see anyone today really giving any data that can support that at all. And I think part of it has to do with, first of all, an anisole is no longer just an anisole.
A what?
An anisole, as in trichloroanisole, is no longer just an anisole.
Yeah, okay.
Today we have trichloroanisole, of course, tetrachloroanisole, tribromoanisole. They all have, from an organoleptic point of view, from a sensory point of view, they're all remarkably similar. As a matter of fact, I challenge you to do something. Let's sit down, let's have all these anisoles in front of us, and let's see who can pick it up, the right one.
Yep.
You're going to fail, I'm going to fail, as hundreds of people have failed in Weinfeld's workshops that have been organized around the world. For one simple reason. our ability to detect the difference between tribrominosol and trichloroanisole, especially at low levels of contamination, in the rush environment of a wine contest, it's not that easy, believe me, even in a quiet atmosphere in water, let alone in wine, that can mask a lot of those effects. So I think you should, out of that figure, you should deduct some off the bat. Some should be deducted because it's not necessarily a trichloroanisole, could be any other kind of anisole. In addition to that, I think a lot of wine faults are not accurately pinpointed. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I have seen people with breath that it's figuratively jumping out of the glass and bite them in the nose, and they still think it's cork. And I certainly have a problem with the 5% failure rate, because I think if that failure rate was still that, I don't think you would have an 80% market share for cork. I think we'd have a much, much lower market share for cork than you have today. All in all, if you account, I'm not saying that you cannot have 5% failure rate
for some brands.
For some brands of cork, properly. You know what? I wish I knew who they were, because my problem is today, it's not TCA. The problem for Amarin today is differentiation, because we have invested, all in all, a first tranche of 42 million euros in new plants, in research and development, quality improvements, you name it, and then a second one of 12 million. Yet, what comes out of a production line where all these millions of euros have been invested looks remarkably the same than what comes out of a production line where 0 cents were invested. So it's a bit like, who made the disc brakes in your or the brakes in your car? You have no idea. I don't have any idea, and I shouldn't expect the consumer to know who made the cork on that particular bottle. It's with the wineries, it's with the media, it's with the opinion makers that I have to try to make a point, because I do not have simply a budget to go out and touch a consumer. People forget one simple issue. The annual sales of one single aluminium producer are 25 times higher than what the whole cork industry makes in an entire year. It takes the cork industry a quarter of a century to get to what those guys can get in 1 year. I don't have money to go to consumer, but I can certainly do one-on-ones as much as I can and try to make a very, very complicated case for a product that, let's not forget, has a great track record. We know what it fails when it fails, but what about when it does not fail?
We better wrap it up there. Thanks very much for your time.
No, thank you for your time and for the opportunity, and well done on the show, and hello for all your listeners.
Cheers.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Carlos. He's a fine public speaker and sidestepped quite a few questions with the skill of a politician, but he did put his case well. I was a bit surprised he said that land not used for cork could be changed over to some use. I've heard a lot of people in the cork industry claim that the land had no economic value apart from cork. As you may not know, I'm currently in Australia setting up 3050, my wine tasting business over here. So to keep up with the Aussie theme, I thought next week we'd be talking with David Paxton from Paxton Vineyards in Australia. David talks to us about a topic that is very important to many Aussies, water management. Without irrigation, the wines that feed the big wine-producing regions of Riverland and Riverina would certainly not be suitable for winemaking. And with much of the 4- and 5-pound wines that make Australia number one in the UK coming from there, the UK would simply not enjoy the quality of Australian wines we currently do. But with still a drought raging on, although I must admit recently it has abated a wee bit, this topic is very important. Just before I sign off, we've got this week's joke. I hope you've enjoyed the jokes and quotes. I know they're not exactly highbrow, and this week is no exception. But since it's all about wine and health, we have the top 10 possible medical warnings that could be used on a bottle of wine. Number 10, warning. Consumption of wine may lead you to believe that ex-lovers are really dying for you to phone them at 4 o'clock in the morning. Number 9, warning. Consumption of wine may leave you wondering what the hell happened to your trousers. Number 8, warning. Consumption of wine may make you think that you can logically converse with members of the opposite sex without spitting. Coming in at number 7, we have Warning, consumption of wine may cause an influx in time-space continuum, whereby small and sometimes large gaps of time may literally disappear. Number six, we have warning. Warning, consumption of wine may make you think you can have mystical kung fu powers. In the top half, we have number five, warning. Consumption of wine may make you think you're whispering when you're not. Number four, consumption of wine may cause you to roll over in the morning and see something really scary, whose name or species you can't remember. Coming in at number three, warning. Consumption of wine may lead you to think people are laughing with you. Coming in at number two, we have warning. Consumption of wine may create the illusion that you're tougher, handsomer, and smarter than some really, really big guy named Frank. And my favorite, particularly given that I'm going to a wedding tonight, is warning. Consumption of wine is a major factor in dancing like a moron. That ends this week's Look at Wine. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.